Hello, my name is Raj Mehta, and welcome to Richard Lehman Discusses EBM. How are you today, Richard?
I'm fine, thanks, Raj. We're going to try and grasp a nettle today, which is the place of meta-analysis in EBM. And I suggested that we take the view that meta-analysis is a necessary evil, and we will know that EBM has progressed properly once meta-analysis begins to shrivel away. At the moment, meta-analysis and systematic reviews dominate the EBM agenda and to some extent the content of many medical journals. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, even though I worked with Cochrane for a while. Raj and I are going to try and explore some of the reasons why we think that.
So I think this is a great starting point because every physician is familiar with the term meta-analysis. And in the hierarchy of EBM, it has become sort of a cornerstone for guidelines and recommendations. And it's often thought of synonymously as the best evidence, although there are challenges and limitations. And as you've alluded to, it's also been somewhat of a necessary evil. But in fairness to meta-analysis, when it first became prominent, I think in the 1980s, early 1990s, it was quite a revolutionary introduction, and it had led to a lot of positive change in the early EBM movement. So I think to give its fair due, perhaps that's where we should begin, and then we can transition to some of the more modern challenges that we've had with meta-analysis as become more institutionalized and ingrained in our EBM process.
So you want me to start with the good, do you? And for afterwards. I'm inclined to go straight to the evil. The evil that that meta-analysis tries to combat is the fact that trials haven't been properly designed in the first place to give clear results. And you can bet your bottom dollar that if a meta-analysis is necessary, truly necessary, then the sample sizes of the key trials have been miscalculated, and the effect size that is going to emerge is one that might be significant at the population level, but will probably not be communicable to individual patients as being of benefit to them. Otherwise, it would be a barn door size, and you wouldn't need a large trial. So meta-analysis was a technique for combining studies of inadequate power so that you could generalize from them statistically into conclusions that indicated a particular intervention was going to benefit a significant number of people. And significance, of course, is a term that has become solidified into the 1 in 20 probability range. That was also something that was happening in the 70s and 80s. And the pioneer of this technique, well, there were many, but Ian Chalmers is a name I keep mentioning. He was looking at trials of various interventions in obstetrics, saving babies' lives. And these results were often inconclusive in smaller trials, but became conclusive once you had totted up the intervention in all the trials that had been done. And the classic way of totting them up was the FOREST chart, which we still use today and appears on the Cochrane logo. So that was a good innovation, and it has proved continuingly good in some ways, but I think has major disadvantages, which we're going to discuss later.
Thank you, Richard. That's a fantastic review. And for many of us, this took place before our careers in medicine began. So even though I'm used to this notion that you can have many small trials that maybe have inconclusive or conflicting results, and then combining them in a nice force plot, I just take that for granted. But I can see how in that era in the 1980s and 1990s, this is really transformative and allowed medicine and evidence to progress, because we could get some answers when we had a lot of trials that weren't done. And as you mentioned, a lot of this was necessitated by how trials designs often worked historically, which is you have a certain sample size you have to set before the trial begins, either out of practical concerns, how much you can recruit, or funding limitations. And you may think that you've powered your study to notice a difference, but perhaps event rate were not as high as one would hope, or the intervention was not as drastically large as you would hope, and you come to a conclusion of a trial with inconclusive or uncertain results, and that's very unsatisfying. So the meta-analysis tool was quite helpful. And sure enough, in the EBM pyramid, it eventually kind of became the top of it. And I think people sometimes think of this as the best available evidence, but there are limitations here. And the limitations we haven't really discussed is that when we're combining trials, there's two types of decisions we have to make. There's statistical choices about whether we can combine trials for statistical reasons, whether there's heterogeneity there and so on. And there's non-statistical choices. And this is where nuance and complexity come into the picture, because perhaps the trials weren't exactly similar. Their patient populations were different. The outcomes they were studying was slightly different. Their time periods were different. And then there's a question of whether you can mix studies together when there are these subtle differences. And I think the great benefit of EBM is that it sometimes simplifies what's a very complex field of statistics and epidemiology and data to kind of make it simple for us to interpret it. And for meta-analysis, it does certainly simplify it statistically, but then we lose a lot of that nuance, and a lot of that nuance is where the devil of the details can be.
I agree, of course. And this is without trying to downplay the expertise and the thoroughness and the good intentions of the people who do meta-analyses, because the techniques have been refined enormously. The statistical skills have had to increase enormously. The methods used have become more focused on individual results in the meta-analysis of individual patient data. Network meta-analysis, which tries to triangulate from different types of trial done on the same intervention, and cumulative meta-analysis, which has built up a picture over time of where a particular question is going. And these occupy the lives of many very skilled individuals. The problem is that the more skilled they become, the less skilled we become, and the less we can follow with our necessarily limited attention as chiefly patient-directed clinicians, the less we can really take anything from papers ourselves, rather than depending and trusting on other individuals to interpret the data for us. So when I started reviewing the medical literature every week as a GP in 1998, there was still a certain element of fun and individual enterprise, as it were, in looking at trials and criticizing them, mostly from the point of view of their relevance, I have to say, rather than their methodology. But increasingly, we've had to depend on data processing as the source of our trust in medicine. And this is to some extent necessary, and to some extent it isn't. And to the extent that it isn't, it is a necessary evil, or maybe even an unnecessary evil, if you take into account the fact that there are major clinical issues that could be solved quite easily by greater cooperation between different academic bodies, between different countries, things done at huge scale. And this was proved in the recovery program for COVID interventions, which we've mentioned before. That's a clear example of where that far outdid, I'm trying to think of the right word here, it more or less swept away the entire business of doing small trials sequentially, because they shouldn't be done sequentially in a situation of urgency like that. We needed to know within 3 months, and we did know within 3 months. So we've got a model there, which its initiator has set up and is trying to pursue on a global basis. And I'm talking about Martin Landre here and a project called PROTAS, which he's trying to generalize into other fields of medicine. But this really only applies to nice, simple binary questions. Go beyond that, and we go into a whole new can of worms to do with meta-analysis, which perhaps we'll move on to shortly.
So this is a great point, because as important a revolution as meta-analysis was when it first came about, our reliance on meta-analysis has sort of led to a bit of wasted resource and has kind of allowed, I think, a broken research infrastructure to persist, because we've become used to this idea that we can do different small sequential randomized control trials. And if that one trial doesn't get an answer, maybe we can do another one down the line and then finally get an answer. And this does lead to a tremendous amount of waste, because as recovery showed, we do have the ability now to do more advanced type of trials. We can do adaptive trials where we adjust the sample size based on how the trial is going in an appropriate way. And we can make them large and pragmatic and cost effective when we're doing this. And recovery did a trial that was 10 times bigger than a trial that would have taken much longer if it had been done in a more traditional way, and sort of leads an idea of how we can do future large RCTs that would hopefully sort of make meta-analysis a bit obsolete. And relying on this idea that we can just do a meta-analysis kind of allows us to indulge, I think, in some of our worst practices of how trial designs go. Not that anyone wants small trials, but we are all beholden to how institutions and government, private agencies, regulations, and funding bodies work. And until there's a change at that level, we're sort of stuck in this environment, which kind of persists this waste.
Yes, these are points that were made over the last three decades by Ian Chalmers, to repeat his name yet again. The small trials are often really unethical, because they don't, the human volunteering involved, the risk-taking by the individuals concerned, is not being honored by getting a result that means anything in itself. And I think ethics committees ought to take that into account. There's a great urge, there's a great pressure on academics in particular to keep producing small studies, any studies, anything that can get into print. This needs to change. And meta-analysis perhaps excuses that to a certain extent. But there are other issues perhaps that we should discuss. And one of them is the heterogeneity issue. What do you lump together in a meta-analysis, and what do you split up? And there are extremes to this. And I think one of the extremes that's just appeared is physical interventions to prevent the spread of viral infections. Now, that's an enormous topic, and it's been allowed through Cochrane and been interpreted in the context mostly of COVID-19, whereas almost all the papers in it have nothing to do with COVID. And that's an example of a bad question, an overbroad question, and then a misinterpretation by the lay media as to what it means. Now, I don't know if you want to discuss that one straight off, or whether you'd rather move in the foothills that approach that.
I think it's always good to give concrete examples. So for listeners, we are recording this in February 2023, and recently a Cochrane meta-analysis purportedly evaluating the efficacy of masks came out. And it's a great dive because Cochrane has made some wonderful meta-analysis, but this one has received appropriately significant criticism and allows us to evaluate a lot of these limitations with meta-analysis, as Richard has alluded to. So I say we dive in, Richard.
Okay, well, before I do that, it's just worth pointing out that the forest plot that used to be taught in EBM most was to do with the value of thrombolysis in myocardial infarction. And this showed that long before thrombolysis was adopted generally, there was already proof by an aggregation of trials, had someone done that, that this saved lives. So we're talking about a situation of introducing a new life-saving intervention and proving this sequentially and then through bigger trials. And that was a nice illustration. In the 1990s, when EBM was a new thing, we were all rejoicing over this and showing it to our colleagues. Now, this is an illustration of how meta-analysis has changed. As I said, the Cochrane review that we may be talking about next was built up to lump together all physical interventions against the spread of viral diseases, and that includes washing of hands, washing of surfaces, masking, and all the viruses that have been investigated, almost all of which are upper respiratory tract viruses. I think that might even have been specified in the title. But because so much has been talked about masking in particular, this has been taken as a statement about masks in COVID. In fact, there are about 70 trials in it, and of those, only four deal with masks in COVID. And if you meta-analyze those, you would get a weakly positive effect from four not particularly adequate studies. So it's become a debating point as to whether meta-analysis should be used in this way. And I'm taking the view that it shouldn't. I don't know if Raj is going to take a different view. But we're both going to talk about it from the point of view of showing the potential pitfalls of meta-analysis as a method of lumping together huge amounts of different evidence.
I will agree with you, and I think this is a great example because here the real value of evaluating these different trials is looking at their nuance, their complexity, their differences not related to statistical choices. And I think it highlights how trying to simplify statistical choices to reach a conclusion when it's not appropriate, as meta-analysis does, can mislead us in this example.
Yeah. The context, I think, is worth pointing out. And again, don't take my word for this, because it may be a personally biased account. But what's happened in the mask field is that there were certain countries. Hello?
You are still good.
Sorry. You'll have to edit that out. Right from the start, certain countries, notably China and Japan and Korea, all of them, or most of them, Far Eastern countries, adopted a very strict masking policy when this new respiratory virus appeared. And the Western countries were reluctant to follow, by and large. And so immediately the question arose, what is the null hypothesis here? Is it that masks have to be proved to be effective before they should be adopted? Or is it the other way around? Should we say that not adopting masks is a contentious business? Because in fact, over those first few weeks, the COVID transmission rates in those countries seem to be markedly less. Also, I think most of us from the start believed that there was no reason COVID should differ from other upper respiratory viruses in that it spread by aerosols rather than purely by droplets. So that again was a contentious issue. Would you assume that, or did you have to prove that? And in fact, the evidence that emerged was partly biophysical, to do with the size of the virus particles, proof of them traveling in various ways, and then combining that with the seeming observed effect of masks. And to me, following the literature at that time, as I was for the BMJ every week, I was convinced very early on that this was aerosol spread, which was prevented to a large extent by masking, and that therefore the presumption should be on a precautionary basis, as our ICUs were filling up with distressed people, also distressed staff who were unable to look after those people properly, deaths were mounting, the virus was spreading fast. To me, it seemed very obvious that the presumption should be in favor of universal masking until the matter had been settled in some way that was yet to be devised. So that was my initial standpoint. The tipping point would come when it was proved by adequate experiments that masks did not slow or prevent the transmission of SARS-CoV-2. Raj, what are your feelings about that?
That is a spectacular introduction to the topic. And that context is super important because this begins in a time where you have a new pathogen, a pandemic with exponential spread, with significant burden to the health system, affecting population levels of mortality, and masking, unlike medical pharmacological device interventions, have very understood potential benefits, but really understood potential harms. The hazards of this is masks. There's no great unknown harms that are going to come from a mask or that we can sort of put into context. And so the assumption of benefit or the value, I think, is where it begins. And in that moment, until, as you alluded, that we had some way to handle the situation, a short-term recommendation for universal masking made sense. And the burden of proof would have been then, why not to do that out of a principle of do no harm and being protective? So that was the context. And that's also important because that's a distinct question from asking, is mask worth wearing if you're a surgeon in the OR? Or is mask worth wearing if you're a hospital worker? Or is mask worth wearing if you're in the community and you avoid catching a common cold and so on? These are similar interventions, but in different context, the efficacy changes and the risks benefits changes.
Yes. And I was a bit disappointed, to be honest, when members of the EBM community seem to think that the burden of proof was on the opposite side, given the seriousness of the pandemic. And the arguments were various to do with what had been demonstrated in small trials, to do with flu and combined upper respiratory infections. The studies were completely non-contextual for COVID. Then there were the arguments about civil liberties, which I think have always been put aside to some extent in laws about quarantine, in previous pandemics like the flu pandemic of 1918 when masking was adopted. Sure, it would be nice to have some kind of randomized control trial, But after all, the main benefit of masking comes from the fact that asymptomatic individuals are thereby prevented from exhaling the virus to healthy individuals. And so you've got a split between the masker and the beneficiary of the masker. And that's a very difficult situation. It's not the classic situation of giving the intervention to people and then measuring the effect on those people. It's giving the intervention to one set of people and measuring the effect on a different set of people, all within the same population. And so I was flummoxed as to how you would design a good trial like this. And the nearest came with Bangladesh and its stepwise introduction of masking in different localities. But that was quite a way down through the epidemic. And in the meantime, an Australian group had provided a meta-analysis that was casting doubt on masks from completely different contexts. So that was already showing that it's in the eye of the beholder. The kind of studies that you lump together, the decisions you make about eligibility, okay, you've got a Cochrane handbook listing 900 pages worth of how to do it. But in the end, it's down to a few individuals as to how they appraise these things. And they can check them against each other, but they are still judgment calls. And that is simply about the published evidence. It's not about what the evidence is that you need to have or how to triangulate other kinds of non-randomized evidence. And I think these are important points with COVID.
That's an excellent point, because these are judgment calls. And that means they are subjective, and someone could rightly have a different perspective in a different context and choose to make those choices differently. And that's distinct from the very rigorous protocol methodology of how one goes through your statistical choices of combining meta-analysis. And that context and those subjective choices can make all the difference in a topic such as masks, or prevention of viral illness, respiratory viral illnesses, where the context of the population you're discussing this in, the time period, the disease severity, and so on, makes such a big difference. And I think the Bangladesh study, even though it came later down the line, is a great example. We have to take a moment and thank our colleagues, economics colleagues, because it was run by economists. They're the ones who finally did it. While we in medicine were arguing back and forth about the lack of evidence and doing not very good meta-analysis and discussing who is a burden of proof, they got the funding together and they went and they did the trial. So credit to them. And that's a fault on us that we didn't get our act together on time of that. But it was a study done during the pandemic period. And I think to date, probably the best when it comes to discussing this context during community spread in a pandemic. And it found that indeed there was some benefit, modest, but it was certainly there.
Yes, and then there's the question of how you evaluate a physical intervention as opposed to a drug or pharmacological intervention. And there are different rules, really. When you're using a pharmacological intervention, you're dealing with a very complex system. You're putting a chemical into a biochemically very, very complex system. And you cannot argue from basic pharmacology or physiology. You have to do the experiment to know what's going to happen, because there might be some countervailing mechanism which you haven't taken account of, which could completely throw the benefit-harm equation for any given drug. With a physical intervention, it's slightly different. You can start from a mechanistic point of view, because you know perfectly well that certain kinds of mask, i.e. a complete gas mask, will cut out toxic chemicals, for instance, And you wouldn't think of sending anyone into a chemical warfare zone or a poisoned environment without wearing such a mask. And you can then argue stepwise down from that. You're not going to put a respirator on every child in the world, you know, or every adult in the world, or the whole population. You're going to make do with the best physical barrier that can easily be worn. And it took some time to establish which that was. And certain types of mask are clearly much more effective than others. But you can work all that out by physical modeling experiments, which are purely mechanical. What you then have to take into account is human behavior, of course. And that is, to some extent, what your randomized trial is going to show. But does it show it particularly well? Well, probably not, because that's probably best done observationally. And then you've got to take into account the potential for societal harm. Is this really going to make children scared? Is it going to interfere with their bonding with their mates, with their learning, with their hearing, with their speech, all those sorts of things? Those typically can't be measured in at the same time as a cluster randomized trial. So you've got all these different factors which have to be weighed in the balance and have in the end to be judgment calls. And they have to be judgment calls, not just by medics, but by politicians or by medics who try to persuade politicians. And that's why it got so very complicated and non-scientific in the broadest sense. And then we have to consider how a meta-analysis helps us in that. And I would say not very much by and large, but that's just my view.
I think those are extraordinary points. The first one being that there is a big difference between pharmacological interventions and physical interventions. The idea that with physical interventions, we can have some confidence in mechanistic or causal explanations, that we can use models with a high degree of confidence to predict what's going to happen, allows us to use that information to not disregard it, right? And it can help us change potentially the burden of proof depending on the situation. Whereas for pharmacological interventions, despite our best models, we just cannot predict true harms and risks. And sometimes you can have absolutely catastrophic risks that are unpredictable with pharmacological interventions. Another example of this are medical devices. Certainly many companies would like to think medical devices are physical interventions and perhaps don't require the same burden of proof. And many medical devices, unfortunately, do get regulatory approval with insufficient evidence. But the reality is medical devices do fall more closer to the pharmacological interventions, where even though it's a physical intervention you're doing in a person, the body's response and the dynamics of that are often complex and unpredictable. So this mechanistic predictability of physical interventions makes a difference. And certainly we don't need RCTs to tell us to wear seatbelts when driving cars and so on. Another really, really important point here is the nuance of comparing outcomes, because when you're discussing thrombolysis and myocardial infarctions, the outcome of whether you had a heart attack or not, whether you died or not, is pretty straightforward. And it's a pretty universal one that we can agree upon. But how do we evaluate outcomes for masks, judging things like societal harm, the ability of children to communicate, as you point out, things like that? That's very difficult. And that can vary for individuals in terms of how much they weigh one benefit versus another. In a moment in a pandemic where death is occurring and you have exponential spread, perhaps we can justify short-term recommendations to use it. But then when we get outside of that, it's much more challenging. And that complexity and that nuance is worth exploring. It absolutely should be discussed. And we should be asking people, how much do you weigh the value of this? If this is the potential trade-offs between reducing a viral illness, but then maybe having this happen in this social context. And ideally, that should be the discussions we're having when we're having systematic reviews, is looking at the potential evidence, looking at these various outcomes, getting a sense from various people involved or stakeholders about what they value. Instead, meta-analysis approach just kind of discards all that, dumps all that to the time, and attempting to just kind of this data approach to getting an answer. And in situations like this, that's actually not appropriate. We want to do the opposite.
Well, I'm glad you agree, because I think the debate has become heated and has developed a whole trench line on either side from which mortar bombs are lobbed and gas attacks are mounted. And it's become a sort of First World War battlefield, really, which is stupid. Because for science to advance, we have to get past that stage. And I do think that, you know, when there are calls for humility on both sides, that's all very well. But I think the whole personal aspect of this has spiraled out of control. And I'm inclined to apologize for my own views on the basis that this was extremely close to me, because my wife would have died earlier than she did had she caught COVID. And for people to sort of wave it aside as some kind of cold and mass hysteria and so on, it really got to me, and it became personal. I think now that we can see the pandemic, not in exactly in retrospect, but the early stages of it in retrospect, we should stand back and look very carefully at what we might do if, say, avian flu were to become the next pandemic, and also at the continuing harm that COVID-19 itself is doing to people, and how we can mitigate that, given that vaccination isn't the complete answer. So there are these proper and deep issues for evidence-based medicine, but they're not going to be solved by simply adopting the thing that's supposed to be at the top of the pyramid, which is the meta-analysis. That's not going to help us in this particular situation. And I think we've probably done our time on this now, because although we haven't fully explored the reasons that other techniques could replace meta-analysis, we have at least pointed out many of the possible drawbacks of this particular technique for achieving medical knowledge.
I think that's a great summary. My takeaway from this and discussing this with you, Richard, is that, as you point out, unnecessary evil, there is great value and strength to the EBM model and to the use of meta-analysis in appropriate context to really help guide physician decisions and having a strong evidence base. At the same time, the rules we have for EBM were created in an era where there are sequential trials, where time was not a consideration. Pandemics are slightly different. Physical interventions have slightly different variations to it, where strict EBM interpretation doesn't always work. We have to allow for that. And fundamentally, when we think about meta-analysis, we should be thinking about the subjective judgments, the non-statistical choices that can kind of hide complexity and nuance, and consider whether the question we're analyzing is really appropriate to be analyzed with a meta-analysis, or if we might be better off just doing general systematic reviews and looking at data on its own with some degree of interpretation.
Absolutely. That's a lovely summary, Raj, to which I'm not going to add anything.
Thank you, Richard. It's been a joy chatting with you today.
And you. Bye-bye then.
Bye-bye.